You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 43 of a series in John's Gospel. John chapter 21, verse 15. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." He said to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go." This he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, "Follow me." Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who had been reclining at table close to him and had said, "Lord, who is it that is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, "Lord, what about this man?" Jesus said to him, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." So the saying spread among the brothers that this disciple was not to die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you?" This is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things and who has written these things, and we know that his testimony is true. Now there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. Now here we come to the end of John's Gospel, and we shift from what we've just seen in the previous episode at the beginning of John chapter 21, which is Jesus with seven disciples on the shore of Galilee, feeding them a breakfast of fish and bread. And verse 14 reminded us that this is the third occasion in, recorded in John's Gospel when Jesus had been revealed to the disciples after his resurrection from the dead. And that number three leads us into this encounter, which now focuses on Jesus and Peter. Why Peter? Well, there is a tradition, certainly in the Roman Catholic Church, that says that this focuses on Peter because Peter is the primary shepherd of the church. He's the prototype pope, the one who would have succession of authority over the church as the Bishop of Rome. And of course, that there's a succession of that authority from Peter down to subsequent bishops of Rome. But there's no hint of that really in the passage at all. Certainly Peter is commissioned as a shepherd, but there's no sense in which he is the over-shepherd of others. In fact, if anything, it's very much a servant position, and it's very clear in Jesus' words that the sheep are Jesus' sheep. Peter is not an over-shepherd, but an under-shepherd of Jesus. And when Peter himself writes 1 Peter chapter 5 about himself as an elder, he puts himself simply as one of the elders, a fellow elder writing to the elders in the churches that he was writing to. So we shouldn't see this as about being about Peter as the Pope or Petrine supremacy, as it's called. But it is significant, of course, that Peter is the one on whom Jesus said, "I will build my church," the first one to confess faith in Jesus, according to Matthew 16, the one that Jesus said will become the rock in his name. Peter, the name that Jesus gave him, becoming a stone or a rock who can be built with. He is, in a sense, a leader amongst the 12. And most significantly, he's the one who had betrayed Jesus and therefore is in need of this personal restoration. And so there's a beauty about this, the individuality of this, the fact that Jesus takes the time during these post-resurrection appearances to restore Peter in a way that will be vital for his ongoing mission. But Peter's restoration and commissioning is also archetypical in a sense. It sets the pattern for the mission of the church. We've seen already back in chapter 20 when Jesus breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit, and as the Father sent me, so I am sending you." And here again is a sense of commissioning, and particularly to a pastoral role, a role of shepherding. So after they finished breakfast, again, I find that quite beautiful. The beginning of verse 15, Jesus takes time to eat with them, and it's a restorative thing after a busy night of fishing, a laborious night and a discouraging night when they caught nothing. After the excitement of the miraculous catch and of Peter's swim to the shore, Jesus lets them sit down and eat breakfast first before he calls Peter to walk with him. And speaks to him. And it says, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" Now that saying is a little bit ambiguous. More than what? It could be read to mean, do you love me more than you love these other disciples? That seems highly unlikely. Why would that be the case? That's quite an obvious question, isn't it? Why would Peter love the other disciples more than he loves Jesus? It just doesn't seem to fit with the dynamic amongst the disciples or with anything else that we read about Peter. It could be asking, do you love me more than you love these nets and boats? And some people have read it that way, thinking, well, Peter had gone back to being a fisherman, which was not what Jesus had intended for him. And now Jesus is calling him away from that again. But in the last episode, I suggested that really we shouldn't think that it was a negative thing that Peter was fishing. What else was he supposed to do as he waited for Jesus? How else were they to cover the costs of the food that they needed and supply for their families? Peter, again, was a married man. Certainly, it wasn't Jesus' intention for Peter that he would remain a fisherman. He's going to go into what we nowadays would call full-time Christian ministry, just as he had followed Jesus full-time for 3 years before this. And so there might be a tone here, a sense in which, and certainly there's a sense in which Jesus' recommissioning of Peter is a calling of him to a new life, a different life. But I think the most likely meaning of this phrase, more than these, is that Jesus is saying to Peter, do you love me more than these other disciples love me? And that fits very well with the context, even with what happens after this, when Peter is concerned about the one that loves Jesus, John. In verse 20, it says that he saw the disciple following them. That's what tells us that Peter and Jesus are walking as they have this conversation. And Peter says, what about this man? Verse 21, Peter comparing, always wanting to know who's going to be closer and more loyal. And certainly with what we know of Peter before, it's Peter who has rather boldly said before, isn't it, that he would die with Jesus, that even if everybody else betrayed him, Peter will not, or denied him. And so it seems that what the Lord is doing is kind of reminding Peter of some of those boastful statements that he had made before. Peter had always thought of himself, maybe even still did, as the one who loved Jesus more than anybody else did, was more dependable, more loyal. After all, he was the one who spoke up. He was the one who was ready for action. He was the one who had carried a sword and had cut the ear of Malchus, the high priest's servant, whenever they tried to arrest Jesus. Well, Peter, effectively, Jesus might be saying, do you still think that you love me more than anybody else does? Do you love me more than these? And Peter says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Now, there is an interesting observation here that's often been mentioned. You might have heard it preached on that there are two different Greek words used here for love. When Jesus asks the question, the Greek word that's used is the word agape. When Peter responds, it's the Greek word philio, which usually refers to the love of friendship or brotherly love. And agape, of course, has come to be used in Christian tradition exclusively or especially of the love of God. Now, some commentators put great stock on this because Jesus says, "Do you agape me?" And Peter says, "I filio you." And that's the same in the second time. And in the third time, Jesus uses the word filio, "Do you filio me?" And so the suggestion is that Jesus lessens the standard and still Peter is unsure. Other commentators will say, well, actually, when we look at how these words are used, filio and agape, there's really no clear distinction in the New Testament or in the Greek translation of the Old Testament that these words had very distinctive meanings. The idea that agape refers only to the love of God and only to a sacrificial love, well, it certainly can refer to that, but it's not exclusively used to refer to that, and nor is filio necessarily a lesser love. And so I was just reading Don Carson's commentary, very helpful commentary in John's Gospel, and he really takes a view that we shouldn't make any distinction between the words. And perhaps he's right, but there's still part of me that can't help but think that it's interesting how these words are used, and maybe there is a hint here that's pointing us towards an uncertainty on Peter's part, that he can't bring himself to use a stronger word for love or to affirm his love in a stronger way. Of course, it's complicated a little by the fact that they were probably speaking to each other in Aramaic, and it's hard to know if they would have had two distinctive words in the Aramaic. So we shouldn't put too much emphasis on it, but maybe John, in his choice of Greek words, is telling us something. But just looking at the words as we have them in English, Jesus asks the question, "Do you love me more than these?" And Peter says, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you." And Jesus says, "Feed my lambs." It's a beautiful recommissioning. Feed my lambs. It's a different image. If Jesus has just helped them have a miraculous catch of fish, and being fishers of men is something that's used in Matthew and in Mark to describe the ministry that they will have, well, here is a slightly different picture, a picture that is pastoral. Pastor, of course, means shepherd, the picture of tender care, of relationship. Again, in the context of John's Gospel, going back to chapter 10, Jesus has called himself the Good Shepherd. He said that he would lay down his life for the sheep. He said that he will call them, both Jews and sheep from another fold, meaning the Gentiles, into one flock. And now Jesus is saying, well, these sheep, these lambs of mine, I'm going to need you to feed them. That, of course, is the heart, isn't it, of the role of the church leader, to feed God's people, to fish for those who are not yet God's people, but not simply to gather them in a net and then leave them to die, but actually using the sheep image to provide for them, to give them food, the food of God's truth, of God's word. The shepherd does more than that, of course. He protects the sheep, guards them against false teaching, against wolves. But that feeding is foundational. And their lambs, this tender idea of the young sheep, although again, we shouldn't necessarily read too much into the different words that are used. Just as we've said with love, we have lambs and then we have sheep. And sheep again, feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my sheep. But Jesus doesn't leave it at this, feed my lambs. So the second time he asks, do you love me? And he uses Simon's name. Notice this, doesn't he? Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John. He's not calling him Peter yet. When Jesus told Simon that he would become Peter, right at the beginning of his call of Peter, that was a prophetic statement of what Peter would become. But he's not Peter yet. He won't be until the Spirit comes and enables him to be the rock. And so Simon, son of John, reminding him of his origins, of who he is, simply Simon Johnson, as we would say, the son of Jonah, Simeon, son of Jonah. And Peter the second time says, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Tend my sheep." Here, the word tend is broader than just feed. It could be translated, "Shepherd my sheep, be one who watches over them, who cares for them, who protects them, who guards them." Peter is to be an under-shepherd, but again, the sheep are Jesus. They belong to him. This is a picture, isn't it, of leadership in the church. And if you want to see how Peter applies that to elders in the church, read 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 1 onwards. Not lording it over people, setting an example for them, protecting them, not doing it for dishonest gain, but under the chief shepherd. But a third time Jesus says, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Using filio this time. And Peter was grieved because he said the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Now, how are we to read this? It's not that Peter is exasperated. "Oh, why do you have to ask me the same question? It's so irritating." But actually, because Jesus is putting his finger on Peter's need, isn't it? How many times had Peter denied Jesus? Three. And Jesus is doing a bit of surgery here, going to the heart of Peter and saying, "Look, you denied me three times, but we've got to be sure here of what's happening, of a restoration that is threefold, to reverse the denial that had been threefold." And Peter is grieved because he knows what's happening here. He's not arrogant and rejecting Jesus' correction, but actually he gets the point. And so he prefaces this last statement of "I love you" with saying, "Lord, you know all things." Again, I think there's humility here. Peter doesn't know the extent of his love. He doesn't have confidence that he will never again deny Jesus. But he says, "Lord, you know. You can measure." A confidence in Jesus' perfect knowledge. And Jesus says it again, "Feed my sheep." There's no question here about the restoration. There's no question about the commissioning. And this is a beautiful picture, isn't it, of the Lord's faithfulness and of his forgiveness. It's a beautiful picture of what happens every day for those who are called into a ministry of pastoring the flock of God. Weak people, broken people, people who are imperfect and who fail, and yet to whom the Lord says, "Do you love me?" And from that place of saying, "Yes, Lord, I love you, but you know how much I love you, and you know whether that's enough, and Lord, I'm simply yours." That's where the task of shepherding the flock begins, with a love relationship with Jesus, with a commitment to him and a commissioning from him and a willingness to step forward and say, "Lord, despite my weakness, I will do what you call me to do." Now, again, I've said that shepherds of the flock are weak. I'm not trying to make excuses for them and say that they can just simply, it doesn't matter what they do and how they do it. There are sins that disqualify from leadership. There is a style of so-called leadership, of lording it over people, that is unworthy of a shepherd of the flock of Christ. Jesus himself forbade it. Peter in 1 Peter 5 forbids it again. Those people are not true shepherds of the sheep who feed themselves on the sheep and who control the flock. Your job as a shepherd, if that's what you're called to be, is not to direct people to your vision, to use them as a resource to get done what you think God wants you to do, or them to do, or the church to do. Christian leadership is not primarily about a vision that you call people to that you believe God has given you, but it is about leading people by example to recognize Christ as Lord and to serve him. Tenderly caring for the sheep, loving them, protecting them, providing for them, and showing them the way and how to love and to serve God. So leaders in the church are very important. They have a significant role, but they do it as shepherds under Christ. Peter's commissioning is the starting point of that, but there are many other shepherds, including the other apostles, the other six who were there, and the others who weren't there, the four who were not. And then Jesus continues, verse 18, "Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted, but when you're old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go." Here is Peter, who had talked before about being ready to be martyred for Christ, about going to his death with his Lord, and who didn't, who denied him when the moment came. But here he is, the one who had spoke of martyrdom, and Jesus is saying that's actually what's going to happen. Stretching out your hands was a sort of known phrase or euphemism almost for crucifixion in the time when Jesus was speaking. And so, as John tells us in verse 19, he did this to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. By the time John is writing this, quite probably around 90 AD, Peter had been crucified. Tradition tells us that he was crucified upside down because he said he wasn't worthy to be crucified the same way as his Lord and Master had been. And so crucified upside down, the readers would have known that by now. John certainly knew it, that Peter had already died, but Jesus was speaking about that. He's saying, gee, Peter will be an old man by the time he dies, probably in the 60s that Peter was martyred. Again, tradition tells us in Rome, under Nero, who persecuted the church. So nearly 30 years after these events, rather, or around 30 years after these events, Peter will have served his Lord, will have made him known, will have written those beautiful letters that we call 1st and 2nd Peter, will have tended the sheep, the flock, and cared for them and taught them, will have fished for men, will have overseen through Acts the inclusion in the church, will have done all of this, of course, by the empowerment and enabling of the Spirit who was still to come. But Jesus says, after saying this, "Follow me." And it's a simple and a beautiful phrase. If you're going to do this, Peter, if you're going to tend my flock, if you're going to fulfill the commission I'm giving you, you're going to do it by following me. Just as you have done. Just as I said to you when I first called you, come and follow me, now I'm calling you again. We're back to that place, Peter. We're back to the simplicity of that. We're back to the wonder of that and the excitement of that. And we're back to the promise and the hope of what that will mean and of the person that Peter will become in God's hands. Follow me. And the life of service is about following Jesus. It's about loving him. It's about hearing his commission. It's about caring for his flock. It's about following him as the Spirit leads us to do what he gives us to do. Do you hear that calling? Perhaps to pastoral work or ministry? Perhaps just to a service of Jesus in the place that he has called you to? That's where John wants us to end and land in this gospel. But he isn't finished yet. In verse 20, Peter turns. And I love this. I love the way the gospels just repeatedly and constantly show us this tension within people. Peter has had this great restoration, but he's not perfect yet. And he's caught up, as the disciples so often were, with the petty jealousies and competitiveness that is so unworthy of the gospel. He turns and sees John following them. It doesn't mean that John was eavesdropping in a private conversation. This restoration of Jesus, of Peter rather, seems to be a public affair, just as Peter's denial of Jesus, or Jesus' foretelling of his denial, was public in front of the other disciples. So he's restored publicly, and that's probably quite important. But John is behind, and we know it's John. It's in this passage that John tells us that it's him, verse 24. This is the disciple who's bearing witness about these things and who has written these things, and we know his testimony is true. But this is the one who was reclining at table close to Jesus and had asked, "Lord, who is it that is going to betray you?" But when Peter sees John, he says, "Lord, what about this man?" Peter's been given an insight that few are given, something to do with the circumstances of his death, that he will die as an older man and he will die by crucifixion, a martyr for the mission of Jesus. But he wants to know, what about John, this younger man who's following? And Jesus says, if it's my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. What a beautiful principle, you know. Stop comparing yourself. Stop worrying about what has been given to others. Stop worrying about the praise other people get that you think you deserve, or the opportunities they get that you think you should have, or the blessings that they receive that you wish that you had, or the suffering that they receive, no, that you wish you had. No, of course not. But the suffering that you have that they don't seem to have. That life of comparison, it's so human, isn't it? It's something we all can be drawn into, and no less in our age, perhaps more so than in Peter's time. And it is rife in ministry, people who cannot be content with the place that God has called them to. But to all of us, Jesus says, forget about it. It's a rebuke, it's sharp, it's a tap on the nose, it's a stop thinking about him and you focus on following me. And let me worry about him and what's going to be given to him. Don't we need to hear the voice of Jesus saying that? Not a don't care about him. Of course, we should care for others. Not a just you leave him behind and get on with your ministry, because we should seek to bring others with us and to partner with others. Those are biblical principles too. But at the heart level of how we feel about the successes and blessings of others, we need to get over ourselves and focus on Jesus and follow him. And I preach that to my own heart as much as to yours, but let's listen to it. You follow me. And then John gives us this clarifying comment in verse 23 that this statement spread abroad, and some people thought, well, John wasn't going to die. But John says, no, that's not what he said. John's saying, no, don't think that Jesus has to come again before I die, or that, you know, I'm never going to die. John, by the time he's writing this, almost certainly a very old man, not just old as Peter would be or had been at the time of his crucifixion. But John, although younger than Peter, lived for possibly 30 or more years after Peter's death. And he certainly wasn't 30 years younger, so probably in his 80s by the time of his death. An old, old man by the standards of his time. But he wasn't going to live forever. And so verse 24 says, this is who it is. This is who has been writing this. And we know that his testimony is true. That question, we, is it somebody else writing verse 24? But don't forget, right back at the beginning of the Gospel, chapter 1, John wrote there, we beheld his glory, Jesus' glory, as of the only begotten of the Father. So it's a way that he speaks about himself, describing himself as we, or perhaps as being amongst the disciples, one of the disciples who saw Jesus. But what he's telling us is that we can trust his testimony, eyewitness testimony, a person who was really there, he saw this and heard this. But he doesn't end with that. He ends in verse 25 with this wonderful statement about the greatness of Jesus. The wonder of what Jesus did, of who Jesus was, of how much could be said about him, the limitations even of this marvelous book in which we've had such a vivid picture of Jesus, such wonderful recounting of his claims, of his actions, of the testimony to him. But the things, again, chapter 20, verse 30 and 31 told us, these things are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing you may have life in his name. This is writing with a purpose, that it's not enough to know about Jesus and have your mind packed full of facts about the history of Jesus, but through reading this to know him, the one about whom a world of books could be written. But in a sense, the invitation of this gospel is to let your life and the story of your life be another one of those books, as the story of what Jesus does in you. And in the same way that he changed Peter and he changed John, he will change you and he will make you into the person that he calls you to be. So will you follow him? Will you hear his voice? Will you be his sheep? Will you tend his sheep? Will you care for him? Will you give your life over to being a part in the mission that he has given to his church of making disciples and of calling people to know and to love him? I hope you've enjoyed these studies in John's Gospel. I hope it's inspired you with a vision of Jesus, and I hope it's inspired you to follow him more fully and more wholeheartedly. I'm praying for you as I conclude this, just as I ask you to pray for me, that we remain faithful to Jesus through a lifetime. And though we might not be given to know the way Peter was what death lies in store for us, but that until our dying breath, we too will be faithful servants of Jesus.